Welcome back to Therapy Insiders. I'm Dr. Gene Chirac-Abrad, joined with Dr. Palmer. And tonight, Joe and I are going to talk about running, running mechanics, running analysis, correction, some things you might see, and some of the causes of what you might see. Now, Joe and I have both dabbled in running, Joe more than I, aside from sports. And Joe happens to be married to an avid runner. Is that fair to say, Joe?
That's pretty fair. And so needless to say, I see a lot of running injuries in and out of the office.
Yeah, you bring your work home. Work is always there, right? As most of us have.
But I do agree. It's a good way to exercise. Just you know, there are a lot of people that they can take it to an extreme, and those are your patients that are a little bit harder to treat because they don't necessarily want to hear all of what you have to say.
Exactly. Until they can't finish out their 14th mile 3 days in a row. But there's the other spectrum as well. People just getting into running. They've done it a few times. They ran a 5K. They really enjoyed it. But they were always under the impression that running should be painful. And one of my lines that I always tell them, running should be difficult, but it should not be painful. And once we start breaking down whatever cause of pain they have, they're... You see quick improvements, not only in terms of pain, but you see functional improvements and you see times drop and you see a lot of PRs. And I know another thing I always tell them, that as soon as you have pain, there's compensation. The body does not like pain, and it's a miraculous thing in correcting, trying to avoid the pain. So as soon as there's pain, you're never going to be as optimal in running as you could be.
For those non-runners out there, PR is personal record.
Good clarification. Thank you.
Yeah. So yeah, I've done a little bit of running myself. I've always been more of a heel striker. But in an experiment to see how is best to train and switch, I have started recently to do more of a midfoot strike. And this is a question I get asked a lot is, you know, what should I be?
Absolutely.
And, you know, a lot of the times it's hard to change somebody's natural gait in running. I feel like your best effort to do that can sometimes be futile. So what I like to do is see how they run and then make minor modifications, maybe not, you know, not take a heel striker and force them into a 4 foot striker, or not take a midfoot striker and force them into a heel strike. I feel like that sets you up for other compensations as well that that then you have to deal with.
Well, I'll play devil's advocate to that, and I wouldn't say it's forcing them. I think sometimes you have to make those changes. I'm a fairly avid against 4 foot long distance running. I think 4 foot is necessary for sprinting because you create a rigid lever with your foot, and you can create that explosion. But the 4 foot's not designed. The metatarsals are not designed for that kind of weight bearing and loading. Aside from the first one. So if I see a 4 foot runner, if they haven't had that second metatarsal stress fracture already, which most people have at some point, minus the few lucky ones, at least that I've encountered, I will make those changes. You know, I think there's no one running style that universally fits everybody. I have patients come in and asking me, hey, did you read this book on running? Do you follow this style? I tell them, I don't follow a style. There's no one style that's going to work for everybody. Every single person is unique in their running mechanics and their body composition and their overall structure. So when I take a look at everybody, there's several concepts that I like to incorporate. You know, hip extension, great toe extension, which we'll cover later. But in terms of strikes, you know, everybody's different, and I'm okay telling them, hey, if you're striking on the heel, try to land a little bit more to the center of your foot. But it goes a little bit more than that. I mean, a running shoe can make a big, big difference. What are your thoughts on running shoes?
Well, there's a lot of different brands and varieties. I look at their biomechanical situation and try to push them in the right direction for a shoe. I don't want them to be in the wrong type of shoe as far as your neutral, your motion control, or your stability control. So, you know, I try to get an idea for what they are training in. And you never want to make too big of a jump.
So let's go through. You mentioned the three types of shoes: neutral, stability, and motion control. And every single shoe company makes a variety of each one of those. So patients need to go on and try a bunch out and see which one works for them. So I work with pretty closely with a running store in the area, Charm City Run, and they do a really nice job. I send a little script over after I take a look at my patient, say I want them in a stability control shoe, and then I tell the patient they're going to see a bunch, find the one that works. So for people that don't usually see runners, what's the difference between neutral, stability, and motion control, and which patients would you recommend them for?
Yeah, the biggest difference is going to be the amount of support through your arch. Your typical standard neutral shoe is basically a cushion. It's just a regular cushion. There's not a built up or a dense area under the arch. You're not providing any more support. It's for somebody that has a normal arch and good control of that arch in the foot. Also, you know, for somebody that has good mechanics, good heel to toe, and good pronation through their running style. So somebody with less of an arch, or maybe they're an over pronator, I'm gonna see what shoe they're in. And like I said, I'm not gonna jump too far from what they're in now. The stability control shoe is that middle ground, and the motion control shoe is for somebody with an extremely flat foot, maybe that over pronates a lot. But what I'm looking at there is, am I going to overcorrect this person to where they're going to have other issues if I put them in a motion control shoe and let them go run the mileage that they want to run?
I completely agree. I do everything in my power to avoid motion control unless necessary. To be quite honest, I actually use motion control shoes a lot for instabilities in the foot and ankle for just everyday patients. I have patients that are on the verge of knee replacements that have pretty extensive genu valgum, and I recommend a motion control shoe because a lot of times they'll have compensated to the point where they're collapsing their feet and into overpronation or comparative overpronation, and I get them into motion control shoes and they feel a lot better. But for runners, that's a tough way to run because they're fairly stiff.
Very stiff, very heavy. It's if you haven't seen them, as a therapist, you should really go check them out. You should know the difference, and you should be able to recognize the difference by looking at somebody's shoe right away. The biggest thing you're going to notice about each is the neutral is typically going to have all one color sole. The stability control is going to have some kind of darker region between where the arch of your foot would go. It's a denser cushion there and provides a little bit more structure. And the motion control shoe, you're going to see as it doesn't even look like it has a shoe shape. It's pretty much like a brick.
A form-fitting foot brick. So you, if you want to take a look at it, just Google the Beast, Brooks the Beast, and you'll see what it means. But like Joe was saying, do yourselves a favor. Go to the store. Go to a running store and tell them, bring over a neutral shoe, a stability shoe, and motion control shoe. Try them on for yourselves. Try to bend them in half. Try to spin them, because those are the motions that the foot's going to do. And you'll see a pretty big difference between all three, especially from neutral to motion control. So you mentioned, Joe, now that we're going to talk, we've covered a little bit on the shoes, and we touched a little bit on the different strikes. But in your description of the shoes, you also talked about rolling of the foot. You talked about pronation. So I think it'd be good for us just to touch on the normal biomechanics that should happen at the foot. Let's start walking and then go into running, which is essentially the same thing, just at a repeated strike.
Except it's a lot harder.
Yes, because you do it a lot more often. So let's go through that. So when you pure gait, right, as especially as physical therapists, that's our bread and butter is walking. I think a lot of times we get caught up in pain, but pain is a means to an end. Our job is to restore function, and it doesn't get much more functional than walking gait analysis. It doesn't matter what discipline of PT you're working in, you should cover gait in some shape or form. So let me start you off. We start, as we land, we hit lateral portion of the calcaneus, and then in initial contact. And as we go through initial contact through mid stance, what should we expect to see?
Well, you're looking at the foot landing in more of a supinated position as you go to midfoot. That's when you should have that's when you're gonna have your weight bearing pretty much fully on that side, and then you're gonna proceed to a pronation and then a toe off to progress onto the next step and next foot. And what you're looking for, at least when I'm looking at somebody who's walking, is I'm looking for a side to side difference. You're looking at both sides and
symmetry.
And you want to make sure that sequence is happening equally on both sides. What are you looking for?
I'm the same way. It's all about symmetry. I think as human beings, we're designed in symmetrical fashion, and therefore we're very much designed to pick up asymmetries. One big issue with running is pronation, and probably not what you're thinking as I say that. I think it's the overcorrection of pronation that's the biggest issue. I know people, I get runners in all the time and say, oh yeah, I've been looked at before, and they say I overpronate, and they've been put in orthotics, they've been put in shoes that they shouldn't be put in, and when I take a look at them, they're not overpronating. There's always that chance that it was corrected, sure, but based on looking at them, you know, you need pronation. Like you said, you're going to pronate from that supinated position at initial contact. As you go into mid stance, you're going to start going into the weight bearing phase, and you will start pronating because that's your forced dispersion of your foot. So if you block pronation for your patient or your runner, you are setting themselves up for some kind of stress somewhere else, because every action is an equal and opposite reaction, and those ground reaction forces are going to destroy something along the way, especially if you're putting on long miles every single day or several days a week. So I'm looking for a good pronation. I'm looking, is left about the same as right. And if it's not, that's when I'm starting to think, why is it pronating a little bit more or pronating a little bit less?
Right. And the only time I'm really noticing that I gotta do something about that pronation, because I think you make a good point, is if while I'm looking at them, I can either see it, or when I slow it down, I can see that it looks like they're breaking their ankle every time that they land, and that's when the pronation happens too quickly.
That's poor eccentric control of the foot, right?
That's what I start to work on typically.
Absolutely,
is that landing and trying to help them create that arch with both intrinsic foot strength as well as helping them slow down that pronation progression to the toe.
Absolutely. Now we'll get back to some of our techniques and some of the things we do to help runners and exercises, but let's back it way up to the start. Let's say you have a patient coming in that's a runner. They were recommended to you because they know you see a lot of runners. And let's say they come in with hip pain. I know I see this a lot. It's either anterior hip pain right around the groin area, or it's a little bit of a wraparound pain that kind of starts in the back and forward to that anterior hip portion. So you have that patient that comes in. You do your subjective assessment. You have a few things in your mind, right? So as always with biomechanics in that area, the SI joint can refer pain there. The actual hip joint can be painful there. And a few times you might have lumbar radicular symptoms as well. So what would you do at that point?
And you also want to do an assessment on the actual musculature, especially with overuse type injuries. You do need to at least look into tendinopathies. I think they do happen in runners. But at that point, I'm going through my biomechanical analysis, just like you're saying. And I'm looking at their range of motion, again, symmetry, and I'm taking their muscle strength, looking for key things that they're telling me as far as where the pain starts, when the pain starts. Is it only at the beginning of the run? Is it does it only start when they're 5 miles into the run? Those things are crucial in helping me to understand, what type of dysfunction they're coming in with. So I'm looking at all of that, and I'm looking at I want them to bring in their running shoes because I want to look at the shoes. I want to see what I can tell about how they're landing when they're not in my clinic. And then I'm going to watch them on the treadmill. I'm going to watch them run, and I'm going to look to see how everything is going. If I can, I like to capture that on some kind of video so that I can then show them what's going on. But what specifically are you looking for when you're doing your biomechanical screen?
So if they're complaining around pain in that area, or even if it's knee pain, lateral knee pain right around that Gerty's tubercle. So patients come in with what they read on the internet or have been seen by several other clinicians for IT band syndrome. And they, by the way, do you stretch the IT band, Joe?
I stretch the gluteus maximus.
And the TFL?
And the TFL.
Well, you know my feelings on stretching, and we've covered that in the previous podcast, and that's going to be on our website soon. But, as soon as I hear that they've been told to stretch their IT band, I find out the name of the clinician that told them that, and they're put in my black book forever and ever. You know, that's a exercise in futility is stretching the IT band. But like you said, the IT band comes from two muscular structures, the glute medius maximus and the TFL. So that's something I always go back up and look at. And, you know, there's two main structures that are going to cause issues in those muscles. One would be the lumbar spine. You're going to look at that L4, L5 level and down to see if there's an aberrant input going on. But more specifically for runners, I'm going to look at the actual hip joint. So the motions I will see most commonly missing in runners would be internal rotation of the hip joint and extension. So if you picture the running mechanic, internal rotation would be happening again as a force absorption at the hip. So if the hip joint is constantly stuck or is limited into internal rotation, it's in an externally rotated position, which is a rigid lever. So that's always going to be stressful for that area. And that's when you start seeing proximal joint involvement at the SI joint and at the lumbar spine. So I'll check quadrants of the hip. I'll do internal rotation. I'll do flexion internal rotation, almost kind of like a scour test to make sure that the labrum isn't involved, with a little bit of a downward force and distraction at the same time, just to rule it out. And if I see that limitation in internal rotation, that's going to be one of the first things I treat, because I do not want them running in that stiff position, because it, without fail, it always causes compensation and pain.
Right. Where are your labrum people having pain?
My labral referral pain is generally into the groin area. So that's why when you're doing your flexion internal rotation hip screen or test with a little downward pressure, the most common area of the labrum that gets either impinged or you see a tear is that anterior portion of the labrum. So when you're doing that scour, they do not like that as soon as you go from lateral to medial.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And the point that you're making as far as that limitation that you're correcting is really, really can be preventative of injury over a long period of time that they're going to continue to run. And that decreased ability to have that rotation is putting more stress on those structures, don't you believe?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. You know, I'm always happy if I'm doing my exam and I do the scour and it's negative, I do the Faber and it's negative, and then I do just the biomechanical and I see internal rotation extension limited. To me, that's screaming biomechanical dysfunction, and they haven't gotten to the point yet of it's a labral issue. So when I see that, I know it's going to be a fairly positive outcome a lot sooner. That doesn't mean that the SI hasn't been involved at that point, which I usually see, especially in runners that come in and tell me they get calf cramping all the time, which obviously could be potassium issues, dehydration, blah, 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 blah. But again, when you have a biomechanical issue at the SI, that S1, S2 segment is going to be, again, with an aberrant input, and the calf and hamstrings get affected quite often. So, but you know, I manipulate the hip into internal rotation. I do the SI techniques, manipulations, whatever is indicated. And, you know, then I put them on the treadmill. One other thing that I do, you were talking about muscle testing, is the gluteus medius is one of the main stabilizers of the pelvis and very important for runners. So what I would do a lot of times is test that muscle. And usually you would find a unilateral weakness more one side than the other. And I would do a wobble at L4, L5 and retest it. And more times than not, that strength increases quite dramatically. So then I know that the lumbar spine is involved as well, at least in some fashion.
And explain to the new listeners what a wobble is, because I just picture you going wobble, 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 wobble.
Well, I mean, if you're going to picture anything, it would be me shaking. But a wobble is a grade 3 oscillation at the segment. So what you're doing is you are sending an input, a proprioceptive input, to the facet at whatever segment you are wobbling. So this is very effective that if you think there's pain inhibition or a segmental dysfunction going on, or if you have a patient that is beyond, if they come in with a pretty bad HMP or any other condition, you can do a wobble to decrease that either pain inhibition or joint facilitation. And, you know, you can retest to know if you made a difference. Like I do, you know, if you're doing L4 or 5, you do your grade 3 oscillation, and it could be multi-directional, or you can do AMP. I do multi-directional just because it's more fun to wobble that way, in my opinion. And then I retest the muscle, always test and retest and see if you made a difference. And like I said, more times than not, you will see increased glute media strength.
Very good.
Do you ever wobble?
I do a good bit of that.
No, I'm not talking about your dance moves, right? We're still talking about the joint testing.
Yeah, well, we won't bring my dancing into this. But the other thing that I'll like to do, and this is based off of kind of when are they getting their pain, but if I think hip stability is a factor and they're telling me that they don't get their pain until later in their run, then I'm going to test their strength before, and then I'm going to have them run for a little bit, and I'm going to test it again after it, and I'm going to see whether they're quick to fatigue. And quickness to fatigue can also point you towards a facilitated segment.
Absolutely. So let's stay on the subject. We're kind of at the lumbar spine now. We covered a little bit of the hip joint and some of the things that you look for in terms of rotation, extension, limitations. But the lumbar spine is critical to rule out, to make sure it's not involved. And a lot of times it is in some shape or form. And obviously L4, L5, S1, S2 are very important segments. But so is L3, because you're talking about the quadriceps. But going even more proximal, I think the joint that or the segment that gets ignored a lot is the TL junction. And that is a crucial joint to check, because that's one of the main rotational points in the body. And as you know very well, Joe, there's plenty of rotation going on in runners to counteract. You have your arm swing to counteract the pelvic rotation. But S1... T12 L1 or the TL junction is also one of the segments or one of the biggest areas or the strongest inputs that feed into your psoas or your iliopsoas, right? Your strongest hip flexor in the body. So I see pain in there a lot, because that iliopsoas or the psoas major more specifically can refer pain into that groin area as well. And I see facilitated psoases all the time that have never, ever been looked at. And I don't care how much you like stretching. You can stretch until you're literally blue in the face and pass out. Unless you fix the input of that muscle and you fix your running mechanics that we'll talk about coming up soon, you will always have tight facilitated psoas. Do you ever look at TL junction and the psoas?
Yeah, I think you can look to that to correct, but I'm not going to give that correction without a hip flexion stretch. So that's where the difference is. I think that just the repetitive nature of running and the dominance that is the hip flexion dominant activity in a single sagittal plane, it forces you to think of the hip flexors as being overworked and understretched.
But that's my thing. It doesn't have to be the dominant motion it is, but it doesn't have to be. If you're getting hip extension, good hip extension, 10 degrees or more while running, and you get great toe push off or extension, I mean, if you look at biomechanical studies and EMG, the motion from terminal stance into swing, that should be momentum mainly. That shouldn't be hip flexors. It is because people are not extending their hip and they're not pushing off their great toe. If they were doing that properly, they wouldn't get as much hip flexion. So you see increased trunk flexion and you see poor hip extension, and that's like a 1+1=300 type of synergistic effect. So yeah, I mean, you can do stretching and it'll feel better. I agree with that. They can run and do a little bit of a stretch. They're not going to stretch anything. They'll feel like they get a little relief. But if you fix the mechanic that's causing increased hip flexion, again, I think is what will eventually give the biggest relief and biggest gains.
I agree. I disagree that all runners have limitations in those areas, but I agree that they should be looked at. Gotta look at it.
Right. So after looking at that, let's say that you bring up a good point. Let's say a runner does have good hip extension. Let's say they are pushing off their great toe, and yet they still have facilitated psoas. Now at that point, there's very few things that can cause it. And let's say you go up and you see they do have a TL junction issue, most likely a hypomobility, either on the left or right facet. At that point, what would you do to correct that TL junction issue?
Well, I'm going to look at the mechanics at the joint and more than likely I'm going to manipulate it. So, based on how it's moving and how it's restricted, what I'm feeling, that's going to determine what kind of manipulation I'm going to do. Is that what you're looking for?
That's exactly what I would do. And we covered joint manipulations in the previous podcast. So if you guys are interested, feel free to take a listen. And if you're interested in seeing the technique, as always, check us out at www.therapyinsiderspod.com. There is a newly formed forum there with various body parts and techniques that if anything you want to see, we'll be more than happy to put up a YouTube video or some pictures, or leave us a comment at the iTunes podcast for Therapy Insiders, and we can show you some of that. But moving on now, so we went from the hip joint, we've covered lumbar spine, we've covered TL junction. Obviously, we have one big joint or two big joints, one on each side, left, and that lumbopelvic structure, and that would be the big old SI joint that causes so many issues for so many people and yet remains so controversial in many, many regards. So I know you can look at the SI joint in two different ways. You can look at it as the innocent bystanders that gets caught up in the compensations from the hip, or you can look at it as a driving factor that will limit hip motion and the lower kinetic chain and can also cause stress on the proximal kinetic chain. So how do you see the SI joint involvement in runners, and what are some of the typical dysfunctions you see and causes of it?
Well, I guess the typical dysfunction is a rotated innominate one way or the other. Mostly you're going to have an anterior rotation. But what I'm looking for is, are we getting good, joint mechanics, and arthrokinematic motion at that joint is really my biggest thing. It's not a lot of motion, but if that joint is jammed, then you have to realize that force and is going to be transmitted straight through the joint, and without any give. it's going to cause compensation somewhere else. So I guess that's what I'm looking for first and foremost. I don't really care whether it's the driving factor or not. If it's not moving the way it should, they're not going to return to running normally until we get that joint moving.
Right, and it's a very complex joint that you can look at in two ways. You mentioned more from the innominate standpoint, meaning you're looking more at it from an A to P point of view. So you're looking at ASIS and you're seeing how they rotate, but you could also look at it from the sacral portion as well to make sure that it's not jammed up in a posterior segment or in a posterior position. So there's two different ways to look at it, and you're describing, again, more the muscle energy technique that we kind of differentiated in, I believe, the first podcast. But you could also look at it in just pure biomechanics, meaning flexion or extension. So anything towards the body is flexion, and anything away from the body is extension. So if you look at anterior rotation and posterior rotation, anterior rotation would be hip flexion, posterior rotation would be hip extension. In terms of innominates. But the other big thing, aside from a hypermobility, just pure limitation of the joint, is the compensation that it creates. So anytime you walk, one innominate rotates one way, the other innominate rotates the other way, and it takes the entire lower extremity kinetic chain with it. So if you can picture one of those innominates or in the SI joint getting jammed up in one of those positions, you're essentially going to create a functional leg length discrepancy. So you're going to create a shorter or longer kinetic chain. And I know one of the big problems with clinicians measuring leg length discrepancies is they put the patient down on the table. And if whoever is listening, if you don't do this, all the kudos to you. But chances are you are. You put the patient down in supine. You take a look at their medial malleoli. If you're super gung-ho and objective, you'll do your little tape measure test from the ASIS to the malleoli, and you'll say, hey, you have a leg length discrepancy. But you can't translate to as soon as you hit ground and as soon as you start walking, that laying supine is not a functional position. So what I always do is, one, I'll have a patient walk without shoes, and I'm taking a look to see if there's a functional leg length discrepancy. And to do this, you're looking at the shoulders and you're looking at the head. As they're walking, once they weight bear, once you have that heel strike into mid stance, if you see a drop of the shoulder to the ipsilateral side that's weight bearing, that is indicating a shorter leg length, a shorter functional leg length on that side. Conversely, if the patient is walking and as soon as they go from mid stance to terminal stance into swing and they kind of in their head vaults a little bit, lifts up, that's a longer side. Now, it's important to determine which one's shorter, which one's longer, because, yeah, you can say if one's longer, the other one is shorter, but you need to know which one is driving the limitation. And then you work on your joint assessments and joint corrections that may cause that. But one of the main ones you want to look at is the SI joint and the pelvis. Do you see a lot of functional leg length issues, Joe, and do you correct them?
I do. I mean, I appreciate the gait analysis there. That's great to look at to get you started on thinking that before you even get there. And then I want to see. I do. I lay them down. I want to see that translates statically as well. But you see the functional leg length, I don't see any other way that you get a functional leg length except from a rotation and a SI joint dysfunction. I don't other than a possible intrinsic foot dysfunction where you have, you know, maybe one foot that is supinated or pronated more than the other that is also affecting your leg length. I can't really see that being caused by any other joint. What do you think about that?
Oh, I agree. I mean, you're either going to be lumbar spine or the SI. Once in a while, you'll have a pretty bad jammed up hip joint. But even like you said, foot intrinsics, usually foot unilateral foot intrinsics don't just become weaker one side versus the other, minus blunt trauma or some kind of inhibitory input. Usually you're talking an L5 issue. So either way, you're going to be looking at the lumbar spine or mainly the SI joint. And not to say that you shouldn't look at all those structures anyway when dealing with runners, but you know, once you become practiced enough, when you pick up on the patterns, you'll know where to at least start going first. But I do a functional leg length screen on every single one of my runners and most of my patients, because you know, patients come in with $300-$400 orthotics, and I take a look at their gait, and I pick up a functional leg length issue, and I find the biomechanical dysfunction that's causing it or the compensation that they're creating, and I fix that. And then I take paper towels, take their insole out, cut the paper towels the length of their insole and put it in, and have them walk again. And again, more times than not, I can't tell you how many $300 orthotics I've put to shame with a few pieces of paper towels. They're not going to be there forever.
Brawn or Bounty, Gene?
Oh, I don't know. We might get a sponsor one of these days, so I don't want to upset anybody, Joe. Let's just go with paper. Let's stay generic.
Paper towels. Paper towels. Let us know if you'd like us to use one brand or the other.
I mean, I use plenty of them, so I'm surprised. I should reach out. Now that you mentioned that, I should reach out to one of those companies. I go through enough of them. but it makes a huge, huge difference, and you play around with how many you put in, but it's completely evident. And the length of time that you keep them in depends on each individual, how long it takes the nervous system to kind of catch up to where the joints are, how much patients revert to how they were. So there's a lot of factors, but putting them in initially makes a huge, huge, huge difference. And I think functional leg length issues are very important to look at, and I don't think many clinicians are.
All right, so you've gotten us this far. We've gone through all the biomechanical analysis. We've looked at the different joints that we're going to look at to help correct any alignment type issues that may be causing other problems. There's still a lot more, but here's the thing. They don't want to hear you say that they can't run. So that's one good way to lose a running patient right there, is to tell them that they can't run. So how are you returning them to running, Gene?
That's a good question, and you definitely bring up a good point. Unless it's something that I think is going to be exacerbated significantly, whether if I think it's a pretty bad labral tear or a very bad disc herniation, just pretty extreme pathologies, I always tell them that take a break at least until you come see me next time, whether it's in 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, whenever. We'll see how you are, and then we'll design a routine to get back into running. So what I always tell them is, hey, you're coming to PT anyway, so let's test you out, do a little bit of running so we know how you are. Can't protect you forever, and that, you know, that usually makes them pretty happy that at least they can do it. But my ratio is usually about 1 to 10, meaning if I show them a new running mechanic, if I worked with, you know, their hip extension and they're getting good great toe push off, driving through. And, what usually happens is when you get more hip extension and you get more great toe extension, your strides get a little bit longer. So you're actually, you're working less and you go faster. So when your strides are longer, you're working less. If you just think physics, force equals mass times acceleration. You can't change your mass, but you can change the force. And so that's what happens. And, you know, I tell them, if you're going to run 10 miles, do about 1 mile now. If you're running 10 minutes, do about 1 minute, the new running style, or just do about a 1 minute run right now, just to see how you do. As silly as that sounds, I mean, nobody does a 10 minute run, but, you know, they end up running maybe 10, 15 minutes and to see how they are. You know, most runners at that point don't really like running in pain. they still might do it a little bit to see how it goes. But, you know, eventually they come back. They give a pretty detailed description of what happened, how they ran, how they felt better, felt worse. And then based on that, you know, I designed the rest of the treatment. What about you?
Yeah, I'm looking at letting them progress back to running at 10 to possibly 20% per week. So let's say they were running 10 miles, and so they want to start, they're going to start at a mile. You know, that's the 10%. And then as they continue to run, and they continue to have decreased symptoms, we're not progressing if they're the same as they were. But if they truly are progressing, then I want them to return, but based on increasing their mileage by 10 to 20% per week. So if their normal week mileage was at 10 miles, and they're gonna increase next week they're doing 11 miles, and then the week after that, you're looking at 10% would be they can add a 1.1 mile, so now they're doing 11, they're doing 12.1 miles. So I mean, you're progressing them slowly, and I'm not letting them go past that 10 to 20% per week.
I feel like I need to bust out a calculator right now. There's just too many numbers
for
the PT mind right now.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, we're pretty much doing almost the same thing.
You know, what I don't want to have happen is they're going to say, well, you know, let me jump back on the training program that I was at, and I'm just going to start again where I should be, because, yeah, hey, my marathon is coming up, and I got to get done.
Right.
I got to get that training program done.
Plus, one of the worst things you can do for your patient is treat them the first couple times, and they get significantly better, and let them have almost false sense of security that this is completely healed and they can get back to what they want to be doing. And I know we have a pretty good sit down session, say, hey, listen, you're getting better, but give me 3-4 weeks. You know, it takes about 2 weeks just for your body to get acclimated to everything you're doing. So, you know, you might be feeling 90% better, but that does not mean you are 90% better. So we have that kind of discussion, and you know, some take it to heart, and some go right back to running and kind of jack themselves up a little bit, and they come right back with their head down and saying, I should have listened. So it's a lesson learned the hard way. You know, we covered a lot of topics. You know, we went through a lot of biomechanical issues. There's tons more that we didn't cover. Resultant effects, calf issues, hamstring issues, glute med tendinopathies. But let's hit on a couple of go-to techniques and go-to exercises that you will use for your patients that, say, if somebody's listening right now and they want to try out, they can pretty easily do and have some benefit. So the joint manipulations, the hip manipulations, the SI manipulations, the lumbar manipulations, you can't learn through a podcast, and you shouldn't learn through a podcast. If you're interested in them, I'm glad that we can show you that there's a lot of different treatment techniques, and we'd be more than happy to show you videos and point you in a direction to help you learn them. Again, let us know at www.therapyinsiderspod.com on the forum or through comments. But there are some techniques that you can use, some soft tissue. I know I like ART a good bit, right at the greater trochanter. So I have the patient laying prone, and all those muscles inserting at the greater trochanter, I apply my tension, and I do internal external rotation with the knee bent 90 degrees, and I essentially use their ankle and their tibia as a lever, and I put my thumb right into the the muscles that I palpate that are hypertonic or tender. And, you know, I apply that constant tension and I go internal external rotation and work through it. Sometimes, you know, the lucky patient will get an elbow in there, but you have to be super lucky for that. And you get some relief, obviously, after you do all your joint stuff. What about you? Anything, any kind of go-tos you do?
Well, I'm going to talk more on the exercise section than I think that there are some manual soft tissue and muscle mobilization kind of techniques that are helpful. But let's talk about an exercise. I like anything that makes the patient stabilize their pelvis in a single leg stance. one of my favorites is a standing isometric gluteus medius hip abduction. So envision a patient standing close to a wall with a level pelvis, the leg closest to the wall is flexed to 90 degrees and then abducted into the wall. It not only works the hip that is abducting into the wall, but it will make the contralateral side stabilize that pelvis in order to keep them standing and keep them level. We can certainly get you a picture of that if that was not a good enough description. But
it was definitely a good description. I mean, my glutes started cramping up listening to that. But we'll get some pictures. Nothing like a picture to see with a little description. Maybe even a YouTube video for you guys. That's a great exercise. I do that one myself. I use it myself on patients. One of my favorites that I actually have every single runner do before and after running is make them face a wall, put a chair behind them just for safety, and their feet are shoulder width apart, and I make them do a squat facing the wall without letting the knees go in or out, valgum or varum, and without arching their back too much, and the main thing is without letting their knees hit the wall. So what you're doing is toes straight up flush against the wall. You're doing a squat, but you cannot compensate. There's no compensation. If you avoid collapsing the knees, if you avoid arching the back, and you make sure the toes are straight ahead, what you're essentially doing is not so much a squat for strengthening, but what you're creating there is a self-hip mobilization, because you're kind of doing a posterior glide at that point. And it is extremely, extremely effective. So I have all my runners do about two sets of 20 before running, after running, and make it part of their home exercise program about 3-4 days a week, two sets of 20 or so, once or twice a day, and definitely before and after running. So that's one of my, that is a staple in my recovery program.
It's a beautiful thing. I think there's so many things you can do with the runners, but you definitely want to make sure that you're limiting their ability to compensate. And I like that exercise as well. Just gonna throw core stability out there. It's important in running, all the rotational aspects. You want to make sure that they're not neglecting it completely. We could be here all day talking about the different exercises that we're gonna give to the runner.
Absolutely. And again, we'll cover some of these. We'll put some up on the website, therapyinsiderspod.com. Check out our Twitter feed at Therapy Insiders. We'll also post some things through there. And if you're interested, if you want to know what we do for TFL facilitation that causes a lot of these IT band issues, reach out to us and We'll post some on the website as well. So we want to know what you guys think. We want to know what you guys want to hear about. We have some exciting guests coming up in the upcoming weeks. We're going to cover various topics. I know Joe threw out core, strengthening core stability, and we'll cover that more in depth coming up as well. We'll talk about thoracic issues. We'll talk about some dry needling. So there's so many more things to come, but we want to hear from you guys. So check us out at iTunes, Science and Medicine, Therapy Insiders. We are still in the new noteworthy section, so thanks for listening and keeping us there. And check us out at www.therapyinsiderspod.com. We have a new forum section. Feel free to comment in the comment section under the podcast and leave us comments on iTunes. If we see reviews, if we see comments, that's going to only get us more and more excited to do more podcasts. Right, Joe?
Absolutely, Gene.
So that is yet another episode. Thanks to Joe. And
thank you all for listening.
Absolutely. We'll see you guys next week.